Thank you. Welcome to the pre-council about downtown zoning, C2 more specifically. Just a quick bit of housekeeping. It is that time again to conduct Judge Alger's evaluation, and so we have a closed session for you for that, but we need to know when you'd like to do that. So the open dates are July 15th or August 5th. We have pre-council items scheduled for the 15th, but we can move them if we need to. So at this point, we would recommend the 5th, but we're not sure everyone's in town at that point, so.
You recommend the 5th of July?
August 5th or July 15th.
Council meeting on the 5th.
On the 5th. August 5th is fine with me.
That works for me.
I'll be here.
We're talking about a review of Judge.
Closed session for.
Alger, he works for us.
August 5th for me.
Annual review.
I'm good.
I will not be here on the 5th. I don't know how essential it is for every council member to be present for that meeting. From my point of view, I'd be willing to leave it in the capable hands of my colleagues.
Okay.
That's risky.
Confidence.
That's risky.
So it looks like August 5th.
August 5th.
August 5th. Very good. All right, with that, we've had quite a few conversations about C2 zoning and the pros and cons of it and merits of various ideas to change it. At some point in recent history, council asked for a lot of input, so you've received a lot of input from various boards and commissions. And tonight, we want to spend this hour just overviewing all of that input, and Tim Teddy has graciously agreed to do that. Tony, will you start us off? Or?
Nope.
No, Tim can't do it.
He's prepared.
Boy, that's the start. I was starting to get a break. Well, I'll start by saying I provided council with a handout on legal size white paper. At the top, it has a black bar that has the acronyms for all of the boards, commissions, and neighborhood associations that you requested input through the city manager from recently. And it's really just a summary table of the written feedback that was returned in the month of April from those commissions. I did put this together, so I'll continue to take responsibility for any errors and omissions, but we did run the draft through the Downtown Leadership Council, and they pointed out a few things they wanted changed. So this is a second draft of that, but it's really just something to give you a quick fix on some of the similar and contrasting comments that you got back. And the issue areas are listed on the left-hand column, and those first four are the ones that were specifically mentioned in Mr. Mathis' letter, and the rest of them are related items that received comment from at least two of the groups. Enough said about that unless you have questions. Just something to give you a little summary reference. I do have a few opening comments, but Mr. Mathis, Mr. St. Germain have suggested that this ought to be more of a discussion where we listen rather than talk about the subject. So quickly, and it is a discussion about C2 zoning, but called it downtown zoning just to remind everybody that we do have more than one zoning district in downtown, but the C2 Central Business District is the prevailing zoning classification. I do have a map, so I'll show that. Here's kind of an overview of my remarks. I'm going to introduce some zoning concepts with my opening remarks. Talk just briefly about downtown development trends from the perspective of land subdivision, zoning, and also building activity. Those are all interrelated things. And then the framing the issues, that's based on the feedback that we received from those six groups. The items that seem to present themselves as concerns and things that were addressed in common. And then very brief remarks at the end about a strategy for updating C2. General consensus of the groups is let's leave most of this to some expert consultant that can come in and help guide us through a process. We ought to remind ourselves that zoning is an exercise of the police power. It's the regulation of private activity for the public benefit, and any new rule or revised rule we make ought to be tested according to that assumption that while we are putting some restriction and burden on private property owners, there ought to be a corresponding public benefit. So we want to ask ourselves, with any considered rule, what is the public benefit, and does it outweigh the burden on the individual? When we talk about conventional zoning, that's basically what we have in Columbia, is a conventional zoning ordinance. It relies on use classifications, and it relies on separation of things. There's also this new thinking of form-based code that's gotten a lot of discussion in the visioning and comprehensive plan and since, and that relies a little bit more on models of what real development actually looks like, and there's a little more sensitivity to scale and also the context in which buildings are found. In conventional zoning, you have use lists, and those are independent of the size and scale of buildings. In other words, a 3,000-square-foot convenience store that sells a range of retail goods is pretty much the same thing as a Walmart on that use list. There's no reference to stores above this number of square feet or below that number of square feet. They're denominated the same. If a list is not, the use is not listed in our ordinance, the recourse that a property owner has is they can ask that it be classified as similar to another listed use. And we go through a methodology to do that. They can appeal. They can say we're classifying them as the wrong thing and they really belong in that district. Or they can request a zoning amendment, and that could be either remapping to a different zoning classification that does include the desired use, or they can ask that the text be changed. We rarely do the latter just because that's going to have a universal impact on any property in that zoning district. As I said, conventional zoning relies on dimensional requirements. It uses space, the minimal abstract space, to try to achieve quality in the form of development. And that's a little bit of, when you think about it, that's kind of a suspect provision or a suspect assumption. We're kind of assuming that by limiting the building envelope in certain ways and introducing the requirements for accessory and supporting uses and minimum dimensions for that, that's all going to add up, that you're going to get something that you think is appealing functional development. So to be effective, all those dimensional requirements require a lot of coordination. We have to be careful that we're not limiting too much or too little. And when applied to downtowns, a conventional zoning scheme can literally, quote, make Main Street illegal. And a lot of folks have made that observation of traditional downtowns with buildings up close to the street, a lot of mixed uses and that kind of thing. By nature, these dimensional requirements reduce the useful portion of a lot. They assume that all land is created equal. In other words, there aren't necessarily natural features that differentiate the surface of the land. Adjustments may have to be obtained through either a plan district process, a variance, which is trying to make an exception for based on one's unique case, a special exception, which is criteria that would be written in the ordinance that would say when these conditions are found, the use can be approved, or amendment of the ordinance altogether. Pardon me. Our C2 district, this is just kind of a quick overview of the rules. It has, as our other zoning districts, a list of permitted uses, a list of conditional uses, and then by their absence, prohibited uses. So it relies on a use list, and that's pretty much what the district consists of, because when it comes to dimensional requirements, there are very few. To maintain an urban downtown, the district in this day and age does not require any maximum height, does not require any minimum yard on any side of a lot. And in the traditional mapping of the C2 district, as we'll see in a moment, follows the old town of Columbia, the traditional walkable grid, very small, tight blocks bisected by alleys, and those kind of work hand in hand. You get that very high density, but You also have a dense and well-connected street network to support it. There is, however, no mandatory coordination with land improvements, so it's nowhere is it said that there has to be this particular pattern of lots and blocks for C2 to be advised as a district. We can read between the lines a little bit in the intent of the district, so if someone's requesting a new C2 mapping, we can say, well, look, you don't have enough street here, you don't have enough connectivity here to support that, but it's not very explicit in the ordinance. The screen, I think it is kind of a mauve shade. This is C2 district, runs from Elm, more or less, as far north as Park, definitely on both sides of Ash, between Providence and 10th. It is got within it some M1 district, which is manufacturing, which doesn't allow any residential and does require on-site parking, but doesn't have a height limit. M1, both the northeast and the southwest of the downtown. That, of course, reflects the legacy of active freight rail lines and the industrial districts that were organized around them. And then there's some areas that have been added in fairly recent time. In the 70s, I believe, or the 60s and 70s, what's known as the OSCO site south of Cherry, that was a fairly substantial addition to the C2 district. It had been R3. The Stevens campus in more recent time, and of course the College and Walnut housing added. And then there's been some isolated locations, generally in north part of the downtown or greater downtown area, that have been remapped C2 recently. This is just a little different view of it. Shows the Downtown Leadership Council study area, which is Business Loop to Garth to Elm to Old 63, more or less. Shows that overlaid on the whole city. You get kind of an idea that the proportionally how much area that is. We have 125 contiguous acres in C2, so that gives you an idea of the size. You could get four downtowns built on the land that is Old Hawthorne, for example. So just perspective. So a very compact area, very small by comparison with all of the city limits, but very big in the mind's eye, perhaps, because we all work down here together and we see a lot of activity, so it seems larger than it really is. There's been changes over the years. We've gotten away from surface parking. At some point, that became a conditional use, not allowed as of right. And, of course, we're emphasizing structures, including structured parking, where we once had surface parking. Downtowns, including ours, are trying a little less to be like the malls. And so they're opening up the walkways. And, of course, that's something that happened recently. Some of the late C2 district is actually on Providence Road, where you have more of what I'd recognize as a C3 general business or highway business district, as it was once known. And then we have some streets that are what you might call front streets. That's where a lot of activity takes place. There's a lot of business, a lot of walking activity and traffic, Broadway being for most, and then 8th and 9th also being these sort of front streets in importance. There's also back streets. And in downtowns, traditionally, there was a little more tolerance for functions that weren't as attractive, that would be in the back of the streets off the courthouse square, for example, if it was a county seat type town, type downtown. It's inevitable you get this sort of sorting out of space. But in a downtown zoning, since there are minimal or no setbacks, the vertical dimension for some communities becomes very important. You manage the vertical space, whereas zoning is traditionally more focused on horizontal dimensions. Amenities in a downtown zoning, including C2, are concentrated and they're part of the public realm, so things like bicycle parking can be assembled and it can be shared by many of the different private uses there. We don't require it of individual businesses. But in our conventional zoning district, you get these lonely bike racks because that's a requirement that they offer their standard minimal share. other amenities like transit and trails. Those can be taken into account in decisions to rezone to a downtown classification. What's the availability of these things? Because in downtown development, traditionally, don't try to put it all on the private lot or the private within the private development. You rely on this sort of commons that's in and around the downtown. A word about form-based and performance zoning approaches. They do rely less on the use classifications and the abstract dimensional requirements. They really, at the end of the day, they look at how the building behaves, you might say, is a phrase that one author uses, and look at more the interchangeability of uses, rather than starting with the use and saying, does it belong or does it not belong? Well, maybe it depends on how the buildings are configured. I'm going to skip over the history for the most part, but just to say this is part of the story, too, that the city has done a number of downtown plans and planning activities downtown that should inform your discussion and deliberations over any changes to the downtown zoning. Some of the trends, I mentioned the grid, the blocks are, I think that should say 240 by 300 feet. You have about an acre and a half of land within each block space. That's not much land. So if we applied a conventional zoning district that required setback, that required on-site parking, et cetera, landscaping, that would probably obliterate the utility of those blocks. They're very, very compact, very small development sites. You get away from that original grid, though, into some of these peripheral areas. You know, there's more land to work with. There could be more expectation for that. The data, again, that reported to you on the size of the district. Here's the issues now. This is coming from the Board and Commission feedback. These seem to be the recurring ones. Concern with parking, especially residential parking, and perhaps the need for some kind of parking requirement and analysis as new are built. Maximum building height, if not a maximum building height, maybe a new way of reviewing building height. Concern about student housing and what we might be able to do about that different to contain certain impacts. It has concern about the demolition of historic buildings and several different ways different groups suggested that maybe a sufficiency of resources or an analysis of the available infrastructure at the sites ought to be something that we look at a little more carefully. On parking, of course, there's surface structured or street, things that mitigate parking demand like transit, bike and pedestrian facilities, and then land use patterns themselves can reduce demand for parking. Give you a little bit of a rule of thumb here. Any requirement of three spaces, above three spaces for 1,000 square feet of building, that's where you're going to get a near break even between the size of the first or the total building space and the size of the parking as the area. If you think about it, the size of a parking space plus the associated aisles and driveways and setbacks and landscaping and things happen, and that's why a shopping mall will typically, if it's a one-story, it'll typically have a much larger parking surface than building rooftop surface. Why do we do parking regulations? Well, we're trying to prevent spillover effects of one property on another by demanding more than more parking than it has to give or that the public facilities have to give. Some communities do maximum parking where there the public interest is trying to conserve land, try to not pave over downtown, as it were. Building height, there's really three forces at work. There's a land economics role where there's a trade-off between building up and building out. When it becomes too costly to build horizontally, of course, you get incentive to build vertically. How much vertically? There's going to be limitations imposed by technology and the building code. And the technologies that are imposed by the building code. And one is at 75 feet, we classify a building as a high rise, and it gets a lot more costly because of the associated code requirements. And that's a generalization. There's a few nuances to that 75 feet, but that's there. The city plan role, too, density of buildings has to be supported by a density of transportation. Otherwise, it's not going to be a good venture to build up and dense if you can't deliver the customers to the building or allow the residents to circulate around the building. Some related concepts to height, floor area ratios, ratio of floor space to lot area, looking at massing, and one tool that communities have used when analyzing height are block diagrams that show kind of in perspective, oblique perspective, the mass of the buildings in relation to one another. You can do, am I doing that block by block? That's a commentary. You can do block-by-block studies and determine what appropriate height would be. Two views of the same building. I should have had the hotel in there, too. But you have some options. You can do nothing and just say the unlimited height works just fine. I'll remind council that that M1 district that you saw in the downtown map, there's actually no height limit in M1 either. There is a parking requirement, though.
And the CID recommended that we eliminate manufacturing.
Yeah, and that was in the Sasaki report. They said we still have some inappropriate zoning downtown, and they were referring to those kind of legacy M1 district areas. And one thing you might consider is whether M1 lots would be suited for residential because it's prohibited in M1 residential. C2, the trade-off would be there'd be the ability to do retail services and residential.
Would it be appropriate to refer that to planning and zoning and CID and downtown leadership for evaluation of M1 to see if it's necessary or, in fact, no longer desirable at all?
I think so, sir, and we could do kind of a block-by-block analysis, too, of what lots
now, at what point do you want us to comment on these slides, at the end, or can we comment on them concurrently?
Yeah, I'll come back to anything okay. Real quick here, and I'm just about to wrap. I realize time's valuable. But some of the feedback we got is reflected in here. You can do nothing. You could establish a maximum height through study, and that would be fairly careful study. You could do conditional height regulations, and I think that's in the CID suggestion, speaking of them, where there'd be an allowed maximum height and then a height where there'd be some further review above. And then other groups commented on the threat finding that perhaps you could differentiate downtown and you could have some height districts within. Student housing, some options there. I mean, these are just some of the characteristics we're seeing. Very high bedroom counts. Bedrooms, of course, have impact on population density, parking, traffic, et cetera. We typically think of density by the unit, not by the bedroom. So maybe some amendment could be done there. There aren't a lot of accessibility features since it's usually assumed that the student population has the ability to climb stairs and this kind of thing to a greater degree than the general population. The downtown location is one where amenities can be externalized. So while we are seeing some more amenities being put in these buildings within the complexes for the students, they can also take advantage of close to campus, close to the types of businesses students like to patronize and so on. And then some of the economic characteristics, there's pretty high rent yield per square foot here when you get down to it. Rental by the person in a four-bedroom apartment is going to compete fairly successfully, at least for a time, with loft apartments, for example. Then from the zoning and building code perspective, it's all just housing to us. We don't really make that distinction, so I want to make that clear that it really is just housing to us. We don't think of it as student housing. But again, here you have the option of just letting the market allocate space, let the trend run its course, and then you have maybe a new big thing takes its place. You can try to manage the impacts that we're seeing. Some have suggested moratoria or permit freezes. We'd warn there that it's important to have a specified objective in view
and maybe it would be a moratorium on upzonings or new zonings rather than on projects and permits and this kind of thing. When you have severe shortages of water, that's when you can do a permit moratorium. But if there's some adequate capacity of infrastructure, you probably want to be careful about during a moratorium, unless you have something you really feel we can accomplish within that pause, and we just simply don't want to frustrate the objectives of that project. Demolitions, this is in the area of historic preservation. There's some regulatory options there. It's been suggested perhaps there'd be more generous use allowance that would give incentive to, for folks to reuse historic buildings as opposed to raise them and new. We already have a delay of demolition ordinance. We could encourage more use of the local historic district and historic landmark designation. And there could also be plan review in certain identified circumstances where you ask to look at what's replacing the historic structure. In some communities, you get removals of historic structures, but you also have a review process where perhaps there's a replica building of some type that takes its place, and that mitigates somewhat the loss. Expansions of the downtown, I'd encourage council to think in terms of what's taking place within those 124 contiguous acres versus what's going on at that perimeter. And refer you back to the map, you saw a lot of light orange. Most of what's at the perimeter of C2 is R3 medium density residential. So that's going to be a zone in transition. So your thoughts about how we ought to manage that. Rely on planned districts, create a new district that buffers it, creates some transition. Do we try to reinforce the C2 in some way so that downtown can be enlarged? There's lots of possibilities there. So here's a summary of some of those options. You could do the, say the C2 is all right, and we expect to see some more of it mapped. We'd rather see PUD or another suitable plan district be adapted to changes to enlarge the downtown or urban area. Some have mentioned R4 district is our great neglected residential district. It allows about 29 units to the acre residential. Does require on-site parking, but has a generous height allowance, so it would allow mid-rise or even high-rise buildings. So that's been mentioned. And then you could do district to be named later. You bring in the consultant to try to craft some whole new approach to downtown and downtown area. I'd urge you to decide first what are appropriate scale of development, what are appropriate uses, and what are desired development standards before going headlong into the code writing. Because if you have the vision first and you have the assessment of what you think is right and wrong of your ordinance, it'll be easier to adjust the tools. That's where I'll leave off. Tongue-in-cheek message. There will be skeptics and cynics as we do this.
Quick question.
Back to the
Since I'm kind of coming in at this process kind of started when I was on council before, so I've had a lag of a couple of years. What is our objective with the changing of the C2 zoning? I didn't see anything in this presentation as what, are, is there a problem we're trying to solve, or is it just change for change's sake, or is there certain things in the downtown Charette or the Sasaki plan that we're trying to address? What are the, so that I can look at this, these suggestions, and frame it towards what the objective is?
Well, you have an opportunity to decide what you're concerned about in light of the development activity we've had, which is quite a bit more in the last 2 years than we've probably seen in the previous 10. We'd seen a lot of public projects in previous years, but the student housing complexes, the hotel, government, and college campuses have all been very active. And so there's been, you know, concern about removal of historic structures, traffic and parking impacts, maybe appropriate scale of buildings. So I just suggest that that's the objective, is an opportunity to weigh in on what concerns you have. We can get some professional advice and a process put together
on how we could decide whether the district needs to be amended and how.
Let me addend what you just said is that your point is, what are we trying to fix? And I think it is sort of interesting to see the tensions in our downtown area. And the tensions are there because there's change going on, change that was never foreseen. Nobody foresaw the number of students that the University of Missouri would have in the year 2000. And it really kind of happened. Nobody foresaw all these mega apartment complexes out on Grindstone or on Old 63. We just did not see it coming, and now it's there. And I think people are reacting. And I think Laura's point is, let's, before we jump into something, let's define what problem we're trying to fix. I want to point out a couple of market force changes that are occurring, in my opinion, that many people who are not paying attention to this may not be following. And a lot of this is secondhand information, and some of it may be speculation. But I want to point out what is, I think everybody knows this inherently, the value of our downtown property has markedly escalated. I mean, people want to do things downtown. Now, they've largely done it on parking lots. Most of these student apartment complexes have been on apartment complexes. So we're not knocking down a lot of buildings, some, but that's what has been driving that. But it is a limited resource, as you said, but there is a lot of demand for that resource. I'll even go so far as to say that I believe this is correct, but if we own a parking lot next to the, just west of the Cherry Street Garage, right? You all know that parking lot I'm talking about. It's in a non-binding memorandum of understanding right now with the University of Missouri over whether or not the State Historical Society goes on in two or three blocks away. But to show you what the price of land is worth downtown, I believe that if we put that parking lot on the market right now, for unfettered C2, we could get $4 million for it. I think that's the market value of that. That would be $4 million to the city. Now, who's going to buy it for $4 million, and what are they going to do with it? Well, they're not going to buy it. They're not going to build a one-story retail outlet there for $4 million. They're not going to build a two-story apartment complex for that. To spend that kind of money, they would really have to build up. So one of the market forces occurring right now as we look at building height is that the value of land is escalating so dramatically that it's just not going to be economically possible from now on to build in these areas two- and three-story residential apartments. It just is not going to work. And so when we talk about putting a height restriction, given the demand for downtown real estate, you know, those parking lots that are still not developed, I think you can look at some of these areas, like the area between Cherry Street on over towards Elm, right? That's the area that is, it's off of Broadway. It's an area that is more adjacent to university. For me, I see putting a minimum height restriction in that area, for example, whether you call it an overlay or what, but a minimum height restriction, if you put a minimum height restriction, you're increasing density of whatever, if it is housing, you're increasing the density of that. You are, in fact, increasing the cost of construction to the point where it has to be permanent construction now. You know, if it's going to be eight stories, it's got to be steel and concrete. You can't build eight stories frame. And if you put a minimum height restriction in that you get steel and concrete construction, you now end up with construction that's going to last 100 years. I mean, you got a building that's going to be there 100 years and is, in fact, more minimal to change, to moving walls and becoming office buildings or whatever, which frame construction doesn't. So I think rather than focus on putting a maximum height on buildings, I think as this is out on the table, I think there should be some areas, particularly those next to campus, where we should have, as part of discussion, a minimum height. You want to comment on that? I'll get a couple more comments.
No, okay. I just want to,
all right.
After Carl makes another comment,
right,
I have another comment to follow
and
up.
I'm gonna, and then I'm going to, before I yield, and again, what's the importance of this to the city? You know, if you put a, if private sector put a 14-story steel and concrete residential facility next to campus there, the amount of tax revenue would be about $300,000 a year, about three-fourths of that to the Columbia Public Schools, the other fourth to the other taxing entities there. So, plus there would be a substantial number of jobs involved in the construction. So there is a huge spillover towards building these taller buildings. And I, for anybody that's interesting, I got some photos of Columbia, South Carolina, Austin, Madison, Wisconsin, I mean, other thriving universities. And, you know, they have skylines, and they have modern skylines. And so I don't think we should just dismiss the possibility that we should be encouraging high-rises next to campus if there's going to be student housing, because I think each of us here would rather have a high-rise next to campus than another mega complex out on Grindstone to deal with no transportation. And the last comment I want to make is about parking, because this goes both ways. Because if you demand parking, if you've got 200 students living in a housing unit, for example, and you demand 200 parking spaces, you're going to attract a clientele with 200 cars. And they're going to park and they're going to drive around. If you, in fact, put no requirement on it and the builder puts no parking spaces in there, well, now that's up to the developer to attract a clientele that doesn't have cars. That's his problem. Now, we saw that with the project on College, the first Brookside. They thought they could get by without parking, and they found that their market demand was greater, so what did they do? They built their own parking garage. Well, now there was spillover, and we've had to deal with that, and we have to deal with that by putting a permit parking in the neighborhoods. We're going to have to deal with that by, if there are cars being stored in neighborhoods, we've got to get out there and enforce the 24-hour rules, and we got to take care of that. We're fully capable of that. But the point I'm making here is that if you don't put a parking requirement, or you might even put a maximum parking in there to say, you know, look, if you want to live here, you're going to be walking and riding the bus, you know, or riding a bicycle. I mean, that's just the only way to get around here, like New York City. So I think, paradoxically, you might want to actually minimize parking downtown and keep it from spilling over. So these are complicated issues. And at the end of the day, it is important to come up with certainty and predictability, because I think it is in our best interest for new residents to live close to downtown, close to the university, rather than on the periphery. It's in the city's interest. And that will happen only with certainty, because some of these projects, these people may spend $300,000 in planning before we even hear about the project. So I'm an advocate of higher density student housing next to campus. That's where I would rather see it. As I've said before, I'd rather see those students walking to class than driving their cars down Rockaway Road.
Yeah, let me just make a few comments. I mean, in large part, I agree with much of what you've said, but since we're offering opinions and market forces and the value of land notwithstanding, let's identify the problem here. And the original problem was historically in 1988. Prior to 1988, the city council used to use a conditional use permitting process to identify areas in which they would want to encourage residential use. And that residential use typically was supposed to be, at least it was thought at that time, that the kind of thing that they wanted to encourage, and this was early in our history, so we were encouraging the kind of growth that we wanted, and we wanted to encourage residential use downtown, was the kind of residential use that occurs over a one-story commercial structure. And that was a relatively cumbersome process, I guess, at the time, but nonetheless, and the city council at that time considered it sufficiently cumbersome that they changed their policy. And in 1988, or subsequent to that, it was nested. The residential uses were nested within the commercial C2 zoning. What they did not anticipate, of course, nor do we blame them for not anticipating this, was this high-density residential kind of intensive use. I mean, this is driven by the students, but it doesn't matter, as Mr. Teddy suggested. It doesn't matter who's in it. It's just a high-density residential use. It was not an anticipated consequence. And that's the issue, I think, that we have to deal with. And you're absolutely right, Mr. Mayor. I mean, the value of land has gone up. These investments, I don't have a particular problem with about height restrictions, actually, in most cases. We can look to the Charette, and there are several recommendations from several of these groups, and when you do a spreadsheet on them, you come to the same conclusions that the mode of the most salient feature here is sufficiency of resources. And that means infrastructure, and that means paying for the kinds of impacts and kinds of demands that high-density residential has on the downtown zoning. Now, C2 has lots of privileges, particularly for commercial venues, and it should, but it has precious few responsibilities that are necessary for residential, high-density residential development. That's what we need to fix. And from my read of this, one of the potential possibilities, and I'll just throw this out there for the rest of the council to consider, is we may, in the short term, we may need to do something to consider perhaps revisiting that method by which we refer this to the Board of Adjustment for conditional use for this high density, until we get to the point that we can get a professional to guide us with form-based zoning and so on and so forth to tweak this sufficiently that we have a solution. Then we can maybe perhaps put in place some sort of planned residential high-density overlay, maybe triggered by bedrooms or whatever impact or other considerations and so on. I think this may be a two-tier process that may require a reversion to undo this unanticipated consequence that we had, and offer a venue that folks, in fact, can get resolution for the projects that they want to build, because obviously they want to build them. We are growing, and yet give us enough time to get the proper advice so that we get the zoning in place, so that we have responsibilities that match the privileges for the zoning category that we're talking about. And that's downtown, and it's very important for everyone. That's what I think the problem is, and I think that's what we need to consider.
And I'm just going to kind of expand on what the mayor had said a few moments ago and kind of what I alluded to at the beginning. What I see is our community is kind of torn at the moment on what we really want. We have a lot of the same groups saying one thing on one project and another, the opposite, on a competing project. I think as the council, we need to sit and really focus. Do we want to be the community that is going to promote the alternative transportation, getting people to walk more, bike more, bus more? Are we going to want to be, or do we want to be the community that says we want to discourage as much development into the fringes of our community and promote the infill development using what we already have? The only way to promote infill is to allow us to go up. And as we're going to be looking at our other zoning classifications too here in the future. So I think those are the key things we really need to decide on now, so that when we look at all of these zonings, we can tailor them to encourage, you know, if you're going to build a new subdivision, to have, you know, condominiums and single family homes and in one subdivision development rather than a whole pocket of condominiums or duplexes, so that you have intermixed developments throughout the community, so we can encourage reuse to go up and have that higher density where the infrastructure already is. But until we make that conscious decision and say that is our goal, I think we're just kind of going to flounder on these questions, on these issues, on these new zonings and what we want to accomplish. So I would like to personally, just like I say, make a clear set of 4 or 5 criteria that we're trying to solve, whether it's parking, high density, you know, lack of building on the fringe, whatever those issues are, and then come and bring all these issues. Because just to look at all of these things, there's so many competing things even on this spreadsheet, that until we kind of look at what we want to accomplish, we may be causing more harm than good and not giving that certainty of what our community expects in the future.
Barbara, we have 10 more minutes, so I want everybody to have a chance.
I think the Historic Preservation Commission and their recommendations and what Mr. Scala said is probably for the short term right on target. There are issues that have come up in the last year or 2 years. Unanticipated, because we no longer have the conditional use permit that used to make sure that residential development fit in with the downtown, because it was just the second story or third story. That's all that it was contemplated. So I think we see from the community or the different commissions that there are very similar concerns with parking, sufficiency of services. We've had a visioning process with the H3 charrette. Now, how do we implement that, or do we let just everything happen, market forces? So there's some controls that we need to put on it because it's not working. So I think sufficiency of the services, traffic, sewer, trash from CID, parking comes up over and over again, and then the overlay. Historic preservation, as we saw with the Niedermeyer, there were concerns about tearing down and preserving and putting things in character. So I like the criteria, the standards that the conditional use permit was: conformance with the character of the adjacent area, location type, height of buildings, which could contemplate in some areas a minimum height as well as a maximum. And we saw from the H3 charrette and the groups that one size doesn't fit all downtown, and that's what we need to aim for. So in the interim, there's off-street parking, adequate utilities, drainage, and other facilities, and traffic congestion. So I think what we're getting at is having appropriate development. We want retail on the bottom for most areas, but we don't require that right now. So those are the problems we're trying to fix. We have recommendations from the commissions, and most of them overlap a good deal. So it's just a matter of putting something in place temporarily while we're getting the long-term solution. So I very much like the idea of going back to conditional uses for a short term, because they didn't even anticipate when they were eliminating the conditional uses that it would apply to anything other than one- or two-story residential.
Let's see. We have about 5 minutes left.
Sorry.
So I think I'm going to be jovial and agree with everybody. First thing is what Ms. Nauser said is, you know, what are we trying to do? I think we are trying to preserve the character of downtown. I think one of the things that surprised everybody with the sudden spate of student housing was the risk of losing the diversity of downtown, which is one of its strengths. I think we all want the walkability, bikeability, busability. And that lends itself to looking really hard at a minimum height requirement to say this is, you know, because this would do a couple of things. It would increase the value of downtown. It would expand downtown in a direction
that's easy, which is up. I think there is room to expand downtown to, especially I think to the west and where these surface parking lots are just to the north of Walnut and Ash. There's a lot of surface parking there that really could be buildings, and that might be where the office buildings go that are missing from downtown. They're just not large office plates. And I really liked sort of the spirit of the CID recommendation, which is to, as much as possible, allow market forces to determine how all of this happens. We may want to put things like minimum height requirements, maybe first floor retail, as things to sort of level the playing field, because right now every developer says, oh, well, it doesn't make sense to put first floor retail there. Well, if you sort of level the playing field and say, well, everybody has to have it, it might happen and might cause the expansion of downtown that I think it's what people want, and I think it's what's good for the developers and good for downtown. And I think also, too, building up and expanding downtown may, you know, when you increase the value of the projects and the expense of the projects, it makes it much more feasible for the developer to say, okay, I'm going to, you know, as a part of my project, I'm going to fix the sewer, fix the stormwater problems. You know, the bigger the project, the easier it is for them to do that. And it's, I'll leave the rest of the time to Ian.
Okay. Mike has to speak as well.
Oh.
I'll take my 2 minutes to focus on transportation. And I often think of ratios of people per private vehicle, people per car, or people per truck. And I think it's fairly self-evident that downtown areas have more people per vehicle than suburban areas, for example. And that could be quantified, could be measured quite accurately, I would think, the number of you know, residential humans per vehicle that's parked for those residents, number of employees in a downtown area per cars that are coming in and out, number of visitors per cars. I see an interplay between parking and the roadways that serve a downtown area. So if more parking is allowed or even encouraged, then that in turn then puts more pressure on the roadways to be expanded because they get congested at peak times. So you can't really take either one in isolation. So I'd be really interested if this data exists or if it could be researched to look at half a dozen other cities similar to what maybe we think we aspire to for Columbia's downtown, looking at the H3 Charette or other planning processes. I think we got a fairly good idea of what we want the downtown to look like, or the majority of the community does, and look at those cities and how many residential how many residents per residential vehicles, how many employees, how many visitors. So we get a sense of what those ratios are and then measure our own and see whether we're on track for the kind of downtowns that we like or not. And that would help guide that metric. I will finally just mention, Bob, you referred to developers of student housing. Taking a multimodal approach to transportation to requests for zoning variances and the provision of transportation for their residents, and Collegiate Housing Partners, who have a request coming up before planning and zoning on Thursday, are very proactive in wanting to provide less parking than it will probably typically be the norm or expected, and instead providing bike share facilities, car share facilities, and even contributing to the bus system. And I would see something like that as being very desirable in a new downtown set of zoning rules.
I very much agree with Ian's comments on multimodal transportation. I'll try to be brief. Things that people haven't said that I would like to see is a review process for if historical buildings are torn down of what's going to be replaced. I like that. I like that idea. I think that was one of the genesis to look at C2, is to make sure that we adequately preserve our historic building stock, of which we have a poverty of, and we should jealously guard what we have with any legal means to protect. When doing so, we do want to increase density. I like building heights. I like the charrette, but the charrette's been changed, and since we built the monster garage, we've bent the skyline of Columbia. I think we have to build up to put it in perspective, and density demands it, and if we're going to keep from sprawling out, we're going to have to go up. So I'm hesitant in regards to height restrictions, although we may want to look in some areas. In regards to setbacks, I think setbacks for residential only might be a way that we can encourage but not require first floor commercial, where we might require setbacks or first floor commercial, but perhaps not both, give people a little bit of flexibility. Overall, market forces haven't been doing a terrible job. I like what I see when I walk around downtown. There's some real quality developments out there. I might not agree with every single one, how every single one was done, but overall, we don't want to mess up a good thing. I'll leave it at that.
Take a short break, less than 5 minutes.